You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Want an impactful way to volunteer for KBOO? Believe in KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change? Then apply to be a member of the KBOO Board of Directors. Our KBOO board guides our strategic work and represents the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application. If you need a paper copy mailed to you, call the station or email applicationboard@kboo.org. That's one word, applicationboard@kboo.org. The deadline to apply is July 25th, 2021.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. On Monday, July 20th, the 12th, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, began a month of peaceful civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. Other state capitals will also feel the brunt of the Poor People's Campaign. The goal is to press Congress to act to protect voting rights and to draw attention to the interlocking injustices of poverty, racism, the war economy, ecological devastation, and what they say is the nation's twisted moral narrative. And on Monday, July 19th, 100 women will descend in Washington, D.C. from the Poor People's Campaign to do civil disobedience. July 19th is significant as it marks the anniversary of the Seneca Falls Women's Convention, which pressed for voting rights for women. Our guest is the Reverend Liz Theo Harris, who is a joint coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. This is a growing movement with coordinating committees in 40 states across the U.S. It's multiracial, it's urban and rural, and it is having quite an impact. And for our weekly Earth Watch, indigenous environmental activists are under attack with increasing numbers of them murdered. The reason they're killed? They campaign to stop environmental degradation, which puts them at the crosshairs with corporate interests who want to exploit and therefore disrupt or destroy ecosystems, not to mention the health of those who live on the planet. And the killings are across Central and Latin America, from Berta Cáceres in Honduras to Black indigenous Garifuna people also in Honduras to now the son of a leader of Chile's Mapuche people. Our guest is Francisca Stuarto, who is based in Chile with Global Witness. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The Surgeon General is warning Americans about what he calls the urgent threat of health misinformation. The warning is part of the government's current push to boost stalling vaccination rates. Dr. Vivek Murthy's advisory is the first under the Biden administration. It addresses an epidemic of misinformation and disinformation and its pernicious impact on public health, specifically threatening the U.S. response to COVID-19. It frames misinformation as having hindered vaccination efforts, put lives at risk, and extended the pandemic. The advisory says combating misinformation is a moral and civic responsibility on an individual and an institutional level. The decision to elevate this issue in his first official advisory comes as some Republicans have used the government's coronavirus response and vaccine messaging as a political wedge. The U.S. will offer rewards of up to $10 million for information leading to the identification of anyone engaged in cyber attacks against critical U.S. infrastructure, including ransomware attacks. ransomware attacks are when hackers steal data from organizations and demand payment to release the information. The Biden administration is launching the website stopransomware.gov to offer the public resources for countering the threat. Another measure from the Treasury Department will engage banks, technology firms, and others on better anti-money laundering efforts for cryptocurrency and on developing more rapid tracing of ransomware proceeds. Officials hope to seize more extortion payments and ransomware cases, as the FBI did in recouping some of the $4.4 million ransom paid by Colonial Pipeline. The move comes after several high-profile attacks that have hit U.S. companies. President Biden's nominee to head the Census Bureau is set to testify today at a Senate confirmation hearing. Robert Santos, who is Latino, would be the first person of color to become a permanent director of the Bureau, which conducts the once-a-decade headcount of people living in the U.S. and all the statistical and demographic data that goes along with the tally. Currently, Santos is the American Statistical Association's president and the Urban Institute's chief methodologist. He would serve as the Bureau's director past the current Biden administration and through the end of 2026, during a key period of preparations for the 2030 census. Cuba says it will allow people to bring food and supplies into the country without having to pay extra fees. It's an apparent nod to the large anti-government protests over the weekend against food shortages, high prices, and the government's mishandling of the pandemic. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel, for the first time, is offering some self-criticism while saying that government shortcomings in handling shortages and other problems played a role in this week's protests. Up till now, the Cuban government had only blamed social media and the U.S. for the weekend protests, which were the biggest seen in Cuba in decades. With the Olympic Games just over a week away, new daily coronavirus cases have surged above 1,300 in Tokyo. It's a six-month high. Tokyo is under a fourth state of emergency. New daily cases have been steadily climbing since mid-June, and experts say they could hit several thousand during the Games. More from Feature Story News' John Matthews from Tokyo.
Seven staff members at a Japanese hotel outside of Tokyo tested positive for the coronavirus. The delegation they were hosting is said to be in a bubble and did not have direct contact with the staff. Still, the new cluster raises concerns that the International Olympic Committee's repeated claims of a safe and secure Games may be under threat. A recent poll suggests 78% of Japanese people are against the Games going ahead. Plus, Tokyo has reported 1,149 daily COVID cases for Wednesday, already outpacing the fourth wave and running headlong into a fifth wave of infections. Still, despite being in the first week of a new state of emergency, foot traffic in Tokyo's major hubs is only down around 15-20% week on week, according to new survey data.
And that's FSN's John Matthews. India and China have agreed to lower tensions along their shared border. The foreign ministers of both countries met on the sidelines of a summit meeting in Shanghai and agreed to more talks. Ishan Garg reports.
India and China say a prolongation of the existing situation is not in the interest of either side. Both have also agreed on calling a meeting between senior military commanders from both sides. The two nations had agreed to completely disengage from friction points in the Himalayan region, but the last few months have seen heavy troop deployments to the contentious border area. Experts say the nuclear neighbors do not trust each other and need to scale back their armies to build trust. They also believe that high-level political dialogue is necessary, especially since several rounds of military and diplomatic dialogues have already failed to resolve the border conflict. Ishan Garg, New Delhi.
I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to start our show today with our weekly Earth Watch. And in the lead up to the weekly Earth Watch, we would like to bring you a clip of a recent part of a recent talk by Greta Thunberg. She became known around the world as a 16-year-old who has been fighting for the environment. And I imagine she's a bit older now than 16. This is a speech she gave this year, excerpts from a speech this year, and it gives us the context of what we're discussing in the fight for the environment. Let's go to that clip now.
There's something I would like to talk about. Our relationship with nature is broken. but relationships can change. The climate crisis, ecological crisis, and health crisis, they are all interlinked. We no longer see the links between them. We only see this far. So what will we do? My name is Greta Thunberg, and I would like to connect the dots. Because let's face it, if we don't change, we are f***ed. Millions have died from COVID-19. Zika, Ebola, West Nile fever, SARS, MERS. Up to 75% of all new diseases come from other animals. Because of the way we farm and treat nature, cutting down forests and destroying habitats, we are creating the perfect conditions for diseases to spill over from one animal to another and to us. The next pandemic could be much, much worse. But we can change. 83% of the world's agricultural land is used to feed livestock. Yet, livestock only provide 18% of our calories. The way we make food, raising animals to eat, clearing land to grow food to feed those animals. If we continue, we will run out of land and food. It just doesn't make sense. The land requirements of meat and dairy production are equivalent to an area the size of North and South America combined. From Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, we have industrialized life on Earth. If we keep making food the way we do, we will also destroy the habitats of most wild plants and animals, driving countless species to extinction. This really sucks for us too. They are our life-supporting system. If we lose them, we will be lost too. In the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, for too long we have been waging a senseless and suicidal war on nature. And what about the climate? We know that we need to drastically reduce our emissions starting now. When we think about the villains of the climate crisis, of course we picture fossil fuel companies. But agriculture and land use together are about 1/4 of our emissions. This is huge. It doesn't have to be like this. If we change towards a plant-based diet, we could save up to 8 billion tons of CO2 every single year. We could feed ourselves on much less land, and nature could recover. Pandemics, loss of biodiversity, climate disruption, acidification of oceans, inequality, loss of fertile topsoil, these are all just symptoms. What they all come down to is the way we treat nature, the way we value nature. We need a system change. But we can fix this. Because we are part of nature. When we protect nature, we are nature protecting itself. And finally, the animals. Every year we kill more than 60 billion animals, excluding fish, whose numbers are so great that we only measure their lives by weight. What about their thoughts and feelings? Some animals plan for the future, forge friendships that last for decades. They play, they help each other. They show signs of what we call empathy. But 70% of the animals we farm live inside factories. In the United States, that number is 99%. Their lives are short and terrible. How will we be judged? It is heartbreaking to know all this, but it is also our opportunity. We know what we can do. We can change the way we farm. We can change what we eat. We can change how we treat nature. Some of us have lots of choices, while some have none at all. Those with the most power have the most responsibility, and most of us can do something. So, what will you do?
most of us can do something. What can you do? And certainly, given the environmental crisis, we hope that all of our listeners are paying attention to the crisis, from the melting of the glaciers to the heat dome that some of our listeners right now are suffering through, and the call that Greta is making and environmentalists are making, but that indigenous people have been saying ever since they have walked on this earth. We have to change our relationship to nature and pay attention to it. Greta Thunberg is a Swedish environmental activist who is internationally known for challenging world leaders to take immediate action for climate change mitigation. Now, a number of indigenous people who actually have been leading for decades now the movement for the environment have been under vicious attack, several of them killed. Across the Western Hemisphere, indigenous environmental activists are facing assassination or other violence and repression as they continue to defend water and lands from right-wing governments and multinational corporations whose priority is protecting corporate interests and profit. In Chile, the indigenous Mapuche people have been leading the charge when it comes to defending protected environmental areas from occupying forces. Let's go to a clip now from Al Jazeera that really shows and explains a bit about the relationship between the Mapuche and nature.
The Araucaria tree is extraordinary in many ways, and not just for its enormous size or its sharp and scale-like leaves. It grows very slowly and can live for up to 1,000 years, a prehistoric species, in fact. But the Araucaria is much more.
The Araucaria is a sacred tree for us. It is our mother and father because it provides us Pehuenche with our food and sustenance.
Maria Romero Cheuquepil is a Pehuenche, the name taken by the native Mapuche who live by the Andes Mountains. Before harvesting the Araucaria's fruit, called the piñón, she asks for its permission and gives it thanks. For centuries, until this day, the Pehuenches have bartered or sold their piñones for survival. They're extremely nutritious. In fact, we're told they also help increase fertility. Can I try one?
Mm. They're like chestnuts.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. On this day, we're invited to eat them for dessert. Maria Romero is a huentuchefe, or healer, and explains that the piñones are more than food.
The Araucaria, the water, the earth, the air that we need to live, don't need us. It is us who need them. That is the Mapuche vision.
The Mapuche believe that man's abuse of nature is causing climate change, drought, and illnesses like cancer and the pandemic that we're witnessing.
The indigenous people of Chile realized long ago that if they overexploited their natural resources, they would die of hunger, which is what happened to the Native Americans in the United States when the white man exterminated the buffalo. These days, the concept of living in harmony with nature is actually becoming mainstream.
So much so that many Chileans who've long regarded the Mapuche with contempt for believing that people should take from nature only what one needs are beginning to understand the need for all to do the same. Lucia Newman, Al Jazeera, Lonquimay, Chile.
Yes, and in Chile, indigenous Mapuche people under attack for, first of all, living in harmony with nature, but also defending nature. Back in June, Mapuche land rights defender Alberto Curamil was seriously injured in a shooting by police. He was left with 18 riot shotgun pellets stuck in his body after police chased his truck and opened fire. This after a protest against an arson attack on a Mapuche home on contested land in southern Chile. Curamil's shooting took place just over a year after Chilean authorities attempted to jail him for 50 years and some trumped up charge that there was no physical evidence linking him to the crime. Environmental activists have pointed out that the false charges were designed to suppress his activism. This led to a UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights appealing to the court for a fair case. He was later unanimously acquitted of all charges, which arose less than 2 years after he successfully petitioned and halted the construction of two hydroelectric projects on a sacred river in 2016. In 2019, he was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize. Meanwhile, in Honduras, a U.S.-trained former Honduran Army intelligence officer was recently found guilty over the assassination of indigenous Lenca environmentalist activist Berta Cáceres. Roberto David Castillo, the president of an internationally financed hydroelectric company, was found guilty of being a co-collaborator in ordering her murder. Cáceres, who was also a recipient of the Goldman Environmental Prize, was murdered in 2016 by hired hitmen after years of violent threats linked to her opposition of the Aguazarca hydroelectric dam. The dam was proposed for a river that is upheld as sacred by the indigenous Lenca people in Honduras. Despite this, the dam was approved anyway, even though it did not comply with national and international environmental policies. A high court in Honduras ruled that Castillo used paid military informants to monitor Berta Cáceres for years, and then, of course, then she was killed. He later coordinated, planned, and raised funds to pay for Berta Cáceres' assassination. But today, we're going to focus on what is happening with the indigenous Mapuche people of Chile. And I'd like to welcome our guest, Francisco Suardo, who is based in Chile, a Santiago-based consultant for the International Climate Advocacy Group, Global Witness. She works on their Land and Environmental Defenders campaign, which highlights threats against activists and pushes businesses, financiers, and governments to protect them. Francisca, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for the invitation.
Sure, and we'd like to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Watch. Now, Francisca, we know that last year there were a lot of protests happening in Chile, a lot of happening on the ground there that was pretty widespread. We know that the Mapuche people participated in it, and I recall during those protests, some Mapuche communities were under attack. Now, tell us a bit about the Mapuche community and what they have been doing to defend the environment. Let's talk about that before we get into the attacks against them. Francisca.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I would like to say first that this is part of a systemic violence that we as Global Witness have documented across regions. And we know that Latin America is one of the regions that documents the most these type of attacks, but also one of the regions that where more attacks are documenting every year, documented every year. So I would like to say first that this is not specific cases, and it goes way beyond specific cases, and it's more systemic violence, racism, and neoliberal policies that are put in place in states that are failing to protect people that are defending democracy, are defending the environment, the common goods, and things that could help us overcome the current climate crisis. So beyond specific cases and actions, I would say that, first of all, this is something that is urgent to pay attention to because it's costing lives, it's costing huge damage, environmental damage, and irreversible consequences for affected communities. In the particular case of Mapuche people, this is a historic resistance that has taken place in Chile, the southern part of Chile particularly. And these people have struggled for years to be recognized by the state, to be protected by the state, and for their claims to be listened by population. So why I'm saying this is systemic racism implies that many people do not take credit for what's happening, and when these people protest, the main reaction is that they're going against development, that they don't want to for all of us to live safe. They're calling for violence, and that's a very damaging and I would say very concerning image that it's projected on these land and environmental defenders, because once they're attacked, public opinion just goes against them and say like that's what they deserve for being violent for harming communities, instead of saying this is something very concerning, because it means that we cannot protest and that we cannot ask for our rights and fight for our rights. And I think that in the case of Chile, that was very well portrayed when the protest started in 2019, and when there was the whole country facing this violence and this state violence from police forces. And that's when people realized that what people were denouncing years and years ago was now happening to all of them. And you know that now we're going through this huge political agreement that it's allowing us to build a new constitution after more than 30 years of 17 years of dictature and almost 30 years of a political regime that used the constitution we wrote in during the dictature of Pinochet. So now we're facing, I would say I'm optimist, and I'm saying that this is a tipping point and maybe a huge opportunity to start recognizing the role of indigenous people, their rights and their willingness to contribute to a plurinational state in which we all enjoy our rights. And yeah, I would say that also the significance that it has land and the environment for them, it needs to be recognized and addressed for all of us, because when they talk about the river, they don't talk about just water running. They talk about sacred places. They talk about the place where they meet. And it was the same with Berta Cáceres. The Hualcarque River was a point for everyone to meet, to enjoy the river, to be and enjoy nature. So it goes way beyond river and land. It's about the territory and the significance of this territory and this common good for them.
Right, and the Mapuche make up, you could say, if this is correct, 12% of Chile's population, the largest indigenous group there. They've been fighting for recognition as Chile's constitution, which, by the way, was drawn up during the dictatorship of Pinochet, is the only one in Latin America not to acknowledge is its indigenous people. So, you know, there you have some background, and much of their land was sold off to farmers and forestry companies. So they're demanding greater autonomy, recognition of rights, and the return of historic lands. Now, tell us about the son of Chile's Mapuche people, a leader of the Chile Mapuche people, who was shot dead recently by the police. Tell us about that and the significance of it, and how the Mapuche are responding to his murder.
Yes, this is a very recent incident, and it was supposed, initially, they thought it was the son of Hector Yaitul, Ernesto, but at the end they defined, because they were very similar to Pablo Machan, who was identified as the shot dead person. I would like to say that this is going under investigation, but the claim is for the communities go. They recall for investigation, for due diligence, and to address it, because most of these cases end up in impunity. And that's why we see how judicial system works, and they work against defenders and not towards their rights and their guarantees. So we're always up for a proper investigation on these cases, just to know what happened, and just to break down the narratives that are safe afterwards, that these people were destroying the companies, that these people are terrorists, and these are terrorist attacks. So we need a proper investigation just to know what happened and who's responsible for these shots. They were shot dead in the head, which might demonstrate that this was not a battle, and it was more an execution. But I cannot talk in detail about this because it's too recent, and the justice needs to do their work, and they have to do their work. It's their obligation. So at this moment, what I can say is that it proves that these resistance often have deadly consequences for people that are in the territories.
Right, and I was just going to say, Francisca, for people who want to find out more about what's happening with the Mapuche people and perhaps who might want to support their demands and their efforts, what should they do? Is there a website or a place people can go to get information and also to offer support, Francisca?
I would say there's many people that are advocating for their rights. First of all, the communities, the organizations they belong to, as ATM, the one that Del Onco Alberto Curamil takes part in, I would say these organizations. Molatima is another organization that is working very strongly with affected communities, not only Mapuche communities, but people affected by agribusiness and forestries. And also, I wanted to say that these killings demonstrate that that's why we need to, that's why we're calling for the state to be held accountable, but also these companies, because at this moment, we don't really know what happened and what's the context, and it's been under investigation, but it's part of a huge spiral of attacks that includes flying drones on their houses, following these loncos and their families, breaking the community dynamics. It includes also surveillance, mayoring campaigns, and it's not going to stop until we address this issue and we recognize that these people are land and environmental defenders. Indigenous people are not looking for anything that is not their ancestral territory because it means something for them. So I just wanted to say that it's important to understand that the killings are the top of the iceberg, but then we can tell, and we have documents in many types of attacks, and they go from digital smearing campaigns to huge infrastructure behind killings, as we witnessed with the case of Berta Cáceres. So I would call for people to take action, to recognize the role these people are playing to tackle the climate crisis, to follow up these conversations, and also to seek for justice, and also to seek for policies in their countries. I know that the U.S. Hasn't put in place any regulation for companies that are might be causing harms in different communities across the world. I know that the EU, we know that, and we're working with the EU regulation that could finally could help communities to seek justice for all of the damages caused in any of the stages of the supply chain. And we're having the Escazú Agreement in Latin America that needs to be ratified for countries such as Chile that hasn't even signed it yet. We have lots of stuff, and I guess people that are interested in these issues can inform themselves, but also act and ask for their governments and to do more, because we need to do more, because it's urgent to do more.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, we are going to have to leave it there. Francisca Suardo, who is based in San Diego, Chile, with Global Witness. Thank you so very much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. We're going to take a short station break. We're having a bit of a sound issue. We're going to try to fix that during our station break, because coming up is the Reverend Liz Thiel Harris, Joint Coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. You won't want to miss that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And that is Avalon by Rhiannon Giddens. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And you can check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in across Central America and in the United States. We'd like to give a shout out to our listeners in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, on Monday, July 12th, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, announced that it will launch a month of Moral Mondays featuring peaceful civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. and other state capitals through August 2nd. It is being billed as the season of nonviolent moral action. This comes after the Vote for the People Act, a groundbreaking bill in defense of voter rights, failed to pass the Senate as Republicans voted against starting debate on it. The plan needed 60 votes to advance in the Senate, split evenly by party. However, it fell along party lines in a 50-50 vote. It also comes after dozens of Texas Democrats fled the state in a last-ditch move to stop the passage of a new voter suppression law by the GOP-controlled Texas legislature. They traveled to Washington, D.C. to speak out against voter suppression and draw national attention to their cause. 51 of the 67 State House Democrats left on planes, while several others arrived separately in Washington, making it enough people to prevent Texas Republicans from attaining a quorum. Now, preservation and expansion of voting rights will be part of the Poor People Campaign's agenda this month and part of the direct action. The Poor People's Campaign's season of nonviolent moral action kicked off with a mass call-in before, during, and after the July 12th press conference call by the group. And it will continue with a peaceful demonstration of women doing civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. on July 19th, the anniversary of the first Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York. There will also be events in state capitals the following Monday, and an August 2nd nonviolent sit-in with peaceful civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. Before we welcome our guests, let us hear the other joint coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, the Reverend William Barber.
When we look at where we are today, what is it costing us in America to have 140 million poor and low-wealth people in this, the richest nation in the world, in the country today? What is it costing us to have 43% of the nation, black, white, brown, Asian, indigenous, to be poor and low wealth?
And you say there's not a scarcity of resources, but a scarcity of social justice conscience. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, there's not a scarcity of resources or a scarcity of ideas. We know that people either uninsured or underinsured, We have the resources to insure them, and if we insured them, that investment would actually lift America. It would not hurt it any further. We know every time corporations want money, they get the tax cuts, but poor and low-wealth people get the short end of the stick, and it's hurting this nation. So there's not a scarcity of resources or a scarcity of ideas. There's a scarcity of political consciousness in the wheel, and our campaign is saying that stops now with us.
Well, let's talk about what this can look like, because you say this is more than any single bill or agenda or political power. But we are seeing elements of what you're pushing for now with some of the Biden administration's most recent measures taking on systemic ills. Do you think that the administration is getting off to a decent start in what you're asking for?
Sure, it's a better start. And in fact, we met with the policy team of the president before the inauguration. We took 35 people into that meeting, mostly poor and low-wealth people, public health specialists, environmentalists, economists, and lawyers, and we laid out what we call a 14-point plan for the healing of the nation. And we argued that you can't heal the nation unless you establish justice. The Constitution says that. So we said healing couldn't just be people being nice in their rhetoric. It had to be a real shift in public policy. Number one, we needed living wages. We needed health care for all. We need infrastructure that's targeted toward poor and low-wealth communities and infrastructure that addresses climate change. We said we needed restoration of the Voting Rights Act. So when we see those things being put forward in the House and pushed by the president, we are glad to see it. Now, the question, however, is getting them pushed all the way to policy and at a high enough level. We are deeply concerned when there are those that don't even want, for instance, the president's infrastructure bill, and we believe even at the amount that it's at, it's not fully enough.
Right. There you go. And that was the Reverend William Barber. I'd now like to welcome the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, along with the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II. She's also the director of the Cairo Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary. Reverend Theo Harris has spent over the past two decades organizing amongst the poor in the United States, working with and advising grassroots organizations with significant victories, including the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the Vermont Workers Center, Domestic Workers United, the National Union of the Homeless. She's a member of the National Welfare Rights Union. Reverend Liz, as I refer to you as, so good to have you back on Sojourner Truth. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me, Margaret. It's great to be with you.
Now, Reverend Liz, first, we would like to offer up our sympathy from the Sojourner Truth family. We know that you recently lost your dad, and I imagine growing up in the household with him, an activist in his own right, and your mom, that was quite an early training for you. But so before we talk about what's coming up with the Poor People's Campaign, just tell us a little bit about your dad, Reverend Liz.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, so my father, Ethan G. Theo Harris, was one of the foremost critics and scholars of the FBI, and he helped to break open the abuse of power that the FBI and federal intelligence agencies was engaging in, you know, from their formation, and also I think really shows to us why it is on all of us to defend our democracy in this day and time, you know, from abuses of power, from those that are in positions of power that are supposed to be lifting up this society, but who have often taken it upon themselves to promote white supremacy and authoritarianism instead of the expansion of our democracy. And so my father, you know, again, exposed, opened up so many of these abuses, so much of what the FBI was doing, his spirit is needed in this time as we all are called to defend our democracy and to really make sure that we lift from the bottom and let this whole society, especially poor and low-income people, rise and live the lives that everybody deserves.
Yes, and Reverend Liz, your past year, I mean, you're not only very committed to social justice work, you're very committed to your faith. I read an article that said that since 13, you were actually a Sunday school teacher, then you went on to be a deacon when you were just 16 years old. But now here you are on the national stage, joint coordinator of the Poor People's Campaign National Call for Moral Revival. Of course, the Poor People's Campaign begun call for by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King just months actually before he was assassinated. Reverend Liz, you got together with Reverend Barber, made the call. I just for true transparency, I'm a supporter and active with the Poor People's Campaign, specifically here in California. But did you have any idea when you called for the first 40 days of action that we would be where we are today and that this movement would have had the impact that it is having now? I mean, coordinating committees in 40 states, you have presidential candidates and now the president talking about poverty in a way for the first time that I had not heard in decades. Your reaction to the impact thus far, I know there's a lot more to do, but the impact thus far of the Poor People's Campaign, Reverend Liz.
Well, indeed, I mean, I think it is so important. What we know about history and today in the impact that the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is having is that when people, poor people and moral leaders and activists and advocates come together, especially when we're led by those that are most impacted by the injustices that we're trying to solve, that we can indeed make a difference. And this is actually how change happens. And so, you know, I've been engaged in very grassroots anti-poverty organizing for decades. You know, I was brought into the movement by welfare rights leaders and homeless leaders. They are who taught me about Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign, and that was, you know, actually called for by the National Welfare Rights Organization and leaders out of Appalachia and American Indians and various folks that saw the kind of coming together of movements and the need to organize back in the 60s that is still so with us today. And when I started organizing, and when I personally have experienced poverty and homelessness my own self, I often would not believe that we could really make the kind of change, the kind of difference that indeed folks are already making. Like you said, poverty is on the national agenda in a way that it has not been in over a generation. We have a president in office who all of us are continuing to need to challenge and call out, but who has said that, you know, trickle-down economics never worked, and that he is committed to making ending poverty a theory of change, not just an aspiration, right? I mean, this is powerful. This is significant. And what is perhaps even more powerful and significant is the thousands, the tens of thousands, the reaching to hundreds of thousands and millions of poor and low-income people and others who have started to organize, have been organizing for a very long time, are new to organizing, but who are out there on the streets, you know, in our communities saying that we can do better. And this lie that this is as good as it gets and that we don't have the kind of resources to actually address racism, to address poverty, that's just it. It's a lie. And so I am amazed and excited by the impact that the Poor People's Campaign is already having, and know that we have been called in this time because we need more leaders to come forward, because, you know, our democracy is under attack. When you live in a country that has the wherewithal and the productive capacity to end poverty and homelessness and minimum wages now and fails to do so, then we need people, especially people that are impacted by poverty and injustice, to be out there calling us into action and calling us into being the society that we can be.
I do want you to talk about this season coming that began on this past Monday, where people in the Poor People's Campaign will be doing civil disobedience, including this action, women's action, happening in Washington, D.C. on July 19th. Reverend Liz.
Great. So indeed, July 19th, as you said in your introduction, is the anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention, where suffragists, women and men from across the United States gathered 173 years ago and put forward a declaration of sentiment, calling on the nation to fulfill its promise of democracy for everybody. And so this many years later, especially given the attacks on voting rights that this country is undergoing, women from all across the country, from different geographies and races and creeds, will be taking action together, putting forward a statement, a declaration of our own, calling on the Senate and calling on the White House to do four things immediately, especially by August 6th, which is the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. We're calling on the nation to pass all of the provisions of the For the People Act, a bill that John Lewis helped to write, that would be about, you know, protecting and expanding voting rights for everyone. We're saying that we have to reinstate all of the Voting Rights Act. The fact that we have fewer voting rights today than we did 56 years ago is just unconscionable. We're saying that we need to end the filibuster, this racist filibuster that is making it so that not just we are denying the democracy that the people of this country desire and are demanding, but also the filibuster that is blocking infrastructure, that is blocking healthcare expansion, that is blocking so many of the things that people in this country need and are demanding. And we're also talking about the need to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That we're just getting started with those demands. We have a whole host of demands that the Poor People's Campaign has put forward, but we're saying that women and all people in this nation are called to take a stand and make sure that the nation hears that, you know, 68% of people are in favor of the For the People Act. You know, a vast majority of folks agree with, and this is cross political persuasion, raising the minimum wage to a more living wage. You know, folks have come forward and said we need to do so much more, so much better, and that economic justice and civil rights and civil liberties need to be at the very center of our nation. And so, again, we will take action on Monday in Washington, D.C., near the Supreme Court, and hope that people will join us online, and then also sign up to be a part of this season of nonviolent direct action that is sweeping the country.
Right, and then the following Monday, actions will happen at state capitals. Reverend Liz, just very quickly, today checks are arriving in the mail for the child tax credit, and there are issues with the child tax credit. It's a step in the right direction. We know that it won't end poverty, but it certainly will help, families that extra $250 or $300 a month, depending on the age of your child. But Reverend Liz, I don't know that the child tax credit even would have gotten through, even though a lot of us have been working on something like this and the right to welfare for a long time, without the context of the Poor People's Campaign. Just a final thought from you, Reverend Liz Theo Harris.
So indeed, we are able to make a change in this nation when we work together. And this child tax credit, we need it to be made permanent. We needed to continue to be universal and be for everybody. But we need programs like it that start with those that are poor and marginalized and work from there. We need to center, like the welfare rights movement and like so many folks across this country have been fighting for a long time. But when we do come together, when we do organize, when we do put that pressure, we can make life better for us and for our children and future generations. And so, you know, hope that people will join the Poor People's Campaign, go to poorpeoplescampaign.org to sign up to be a part of the season. If you're in California or any state across the country, you know, connect up with the coordinating committees in those states, because we have the power to change the society for the better.
Yes, we certainly do. And the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, it's the most vibrant, I'll have to say, and powerful movement that I have seen in many, many decades. So thank you, Reverend Lizzie O'Harris, for your work, your continued efforts, and taking the time to join us. And apologies for our technical trouble this morning. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All righty. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott, our audio engineer, Kiana Williams, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and y'all, please stay safe.
We who believe in freedom cannot live. We'll be right back.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
You're listening to KBOO.